Inside Crime is brought to you by Deterra. The Deterra drug deactivation pouch provides an easy and effective way to dispose of unused or expired medication. Learn more at deterrasystem.com. Stay safe, stay ready with Deterra. I'm Angeline Hartman. I've spent my career as a journalist covering some of the worst crimes in history. My craft is storytelling. My passion is crime fighting. With this podcast, I'm bringing you more stories, candid conversations with crime victims, their families, and law enforcement. We'll journey together as we learn what happens inside crime. Hi, everyone. Welcome to Inside Crime. This is episode 6 of our very special season highlighting survivors and heroes. Today's episode continues the unbelievable story of Saya Rivasvar, who was kidnapped by her mother's boyfriend when she was 8 years old. If you haven't heard part 1 yet, go back and listen to that episode right now. It was September 1988 when Saya and her 6-year-old sister Sarah were abducted in the middle of the night. Deputy Bill McCurdy with the Santa Rosa County Sheriff's Office was filling out paperwork, wrapping up his overnight shift.
A dispatcher came in to our room and said that there was a girl that in the north end of the county, a family has got with them that said she had been raped and that her sister was hurt and that she was hurt. And I just put the pencil down and said, okay, I'm off. And I ran out and jumped in the car and took off because the other shift wasn't out. Just started tearing northbound, blue lights and siren. And in my mind, you run scenarios through your head while you're doing this. And for some reason, I thought these were like older women. I thought they were like college age or high school age kids. It didn't occur to me that they were little children.
Bill McCurdy is now an assistant chief of police in Panama City, Florida. He told me he rarely talks about it, but what happened that day changed his life forever.
I got there, got flagged down by a couple in a little pickup truck, and they said that they had seen this little girl. They were driving down the highway north of where we were, and they'd seen this little girl kind of ducking in and out of the bushes hiding, and it looked like she was hurt. And they got her to get in the truck, and they came down there to use the phone at this store to call for help. And I'm like, where's the girl? And they had her in the front seat of the truck. She was laying in the front seat of the truck, and there was Saya laying there and bleeding. It looked like she might have been in shock, and she was in trouble. And I'm like, what happened? She said, my sister won't wake up. I can't wake up my sister. And I'm like, where's your sister? And the family told me where they found her up the road. In the meantime, I had called for an ambulance and fire trucks and all that stuff was rolling. And I think they were running up the road where they found the girl initially, fire truck was. And ambulance was coming to us. And I asked her who did it. And she told me, she said, Ray did it.
Bill told me it was difficult to describe that moment. Saya had reached out and wrapped her arms around him. She whispered exactly what he needed to know, clearly and immediately. I thought about everything this little girl had gone through, how she found that kind of strength in that moment, and how I would feel if she were hugging me.
She held on to me and she told me Ray did it. When I asked her who did this, she said, Ray did it. There was no question. There was no anything. She knew exactly who it was, which was a former boyfriend of her mother's. So, I mean, she knew. And that, of course, helped catch him.
I can only imagine that it's one thing to come upon a scene like this, but for a victim to just actually reach out and touch you and hang on to you like that must have a different impact.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, you take ownership very quickly.
Not long after that, Wyck was arrested. The news eventually reached Thaya in the hospital. She had been having nightmares, worried that he might track her down to kill her.
I am told that they caught Ray Wyck, and that when they caught him, he was at his parents' house asleep. So he went back after doing what he believed was killing two little girls and leaving them in the woods. After he rinsed off his white bloody shorts on the outside with the hose and flung them over the clothesline and left his bloody hand-printed vehicle with my prints, his all kinds of fun stuff in the driveway on his car, and went inside and fell asleep.
Well, he wasn't worried about too much. He wasn't trying to cover up his tracks
exactly.
Or anything.
He thinks we're both dead.
In the meantime, I'm just amazed to hear, you know, at 8 years old and everything that you had been through, you had the will, the courage, the determination to tell investigators what they needed to know at that time in order to find him.
It, you know, and I think about it more and more as an adult, and it is very difficult to try and, you know, just explain to people that I just didn't think anything else. I didn't think of any other options. I just knew that I needed to make sure that this monster that did this to Sarah and I was caught, and so he no longer was able to do this to anybody else. And that's all I had on my mind, that I needed to get help and I needed to make sure that they caught this monster.
Now, when you're in the hospital, because you don't really know, when you left, you didn't really know for sure what had happened to Sarah, right? I mean, you knew, you thought that she was dead.
Right. Everything that an 8-year-old would assume, a person who's not answering you back, whose eyes are wide open, there's no movement, she's covered in blood, and actually you can see the hole in her neck. I took that all and assumed that she was no longer there. And it's a sight that I can't take back, I can never forget. But I knew that she was with me to get me out of there and get help.
And when does your mother come back?
She ends up at the hospital. They contacted the couple that picked me up. I believe I'm clearly gave them our number, and they call my mother, and she has no idea that we're not in our room. So she goes into our bedroom, sees that we're gone, and comes back on the phone and says, "Oh my God, what happened to my girls?" I don't think we'll ever know what was heard, who was home, or any of that. And I actually questioned it for a very long time. And what I do believe is that my mother wasn't home, and nor was the boyfriend that was supposed to watch us. I do believe that with the information that was gathered, that Ray knew she wasn't home either, and that we were home alone. And that Ray saw her at this bar, and my mother called for the boyfriend that was watching us to come down and make the situation not awkward in her eyes. And that when he knew that he was there, he knew that we were home alone. And I think he took advantage of that. That is my assumption. And with all the information that was gathered And, you know, there was never an answer to that because ultimately everyone just wanted their focus to be on the monster that made this decision to do this to us.
After Wyke's arrest, Deputy McCurdy was still processing everything that happened that day. He knew he wanted to see Saya.
So you didn't see Saya again until that night, right?
Yeah. And I got home and, of course, I couldn't sleep. I had to go back to work that night. And that's when I decided I was going to do something for that little girl that's in the hospital. And back in the day, Walmart, God bless them, they had these stuffed toys that were as big as people. They were huge. And there was this big old clown doll in there that I thought was really sweet. And he was big. He was probably 4 or 5 feet tall. And I loaded him up in the car. I bought him and loaded him up in the car. And I went on up to the hospital. And she was asleep. And I talked to her mom for a minute, you know, and all I could tell her was just be there for your daughter. She's like, what do I do? I said, you got to be there. You know, just be there. Don't leave her. Be there. And she was asleep. And they told me she was going to be okay. And I brought the clown doll in there and I didn't want to wake her up. So I just left it and kissed her on the forehead and I left.
When Saya woke up to the huge toy, it was just what she needed. She says that was the beginning of many positive experiences with law enforcement that ultimately shaped her future.
I joke about it now because it was a clown. And back then, it was great. Now people are afraid of clowns, so it's not as exciting. But to that 8-year-old little girl in the hospital, it was. And so this police department, you know, they wrote me a card and they all signed it.
No doubt, Saya's case impacted everyone who worked on it. Deputy McCurdy didn't see Saya again until it was time for trial.
But I was never called into the trial as a witness. So I never, you know, I didn't have to go, but I did get a call from the state attorney at the time and said that Sai wanted to see me. And I said, well, that's sweet, you know. And so I loaded up and went to the state attorney's office, which was right across the street from the sheriff's office in those days, and went walking in, and she was in a room and she had a dress on, and I was watching her. She was spinning in circles and she looked up, saw me, and she went, hey, Big Bill. So she recognized me. Now, this is a girl that saw me once at a crossroads, you know?
Wow.
A year and a half ago and was in trauma and shock. And she ran over and I dropped to one knee and she gave me a hug and she whispered in my ear. She says, you remember that clown? I said, yeah, the clown doll. Do you like it? She goes, I love it. I named him Big Bill.
Aw. Wow.
Yeah. That, of course, that gets to you.
It sounded like a beautiful moment. Meanwhile, Saya is dealing with a lot, especially for a little girl. After everything she survived, there's much more to overcome. At this point, Saya and her brother still live with their mom, and she's prepping for trial.
So that was very difficult to deal with. I know I'm going to testify. And so they run me through what is going to happen and how it's going to happen. And as much as I am nervous, I don't second guess the fact that I will testify. And then I remember being called into the courtroom. And my 8-year-old little self can't even see, barely can see over the little area where I have to sit in the courtroom next to the judge. And at one point, they ask me if I can point Ray Wyke out in the room, and I'm horrified. And I can't do it.
Inside Crime is brought to you by doTERRA. The doTERRA drug deactivation pouch provides an easy and effective way to get rid of unused or expired medication. The doTERRA pouch makes addictive drugs like opioids unusable in minutes. Just place the medication in the pouch and mix with water. Be a part of America's solution to reduce drug abuse. Learn more at doTERRAsystem.com. Stay safe, stay ready with doTERRA.
And at one point, they ask me if I can point Ray Wyke out in the room, and I'm horrified. And I can't do it. I'm shaking, and the prosecutor asks if I can pick him out in a six-pack. So they hand me this sheet of pictures with people that look like Ray Wyke. Not only did I pick him out, the poor man that drove down the dirt road and saw Ray Wyke in the situation that he was in, identified Ray Wyke from the lineup as well. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, that wasn't the only time I had to testify. So,
Oh my gosh,
it's clearly a test of strength, because I testified at 9, where the jury found him guilty 100% without question. I was stronger each time I had to go through this. I just felt strength. It was after I testified when I was 9 that summer, the attorneys tell my father, take the kids. You're going to get custody. Go. He moved to where his current, at this time, his current wife in Western New York. So he takes us, we drive back to New York after I testify at 9. So we're going back to Florida when I testified at 13 and when I testified at 16. Well, each time the jury is not fooled by this nonsense and they find him guilty. 100% guilty, murder, attempted murder, rape, kidnapping. And he gets the death sentence. And of course, with that comes appeals. And voluntarily, I show up at one of his appeals. Just so they all know that I'm not giving up on this. And I wanted to see this through. So I'm in high school, and this is still going on. And Ray Wyke is on death row ultimately for 15 years in Florida. During those 15 years, he wrote a 15-page letter and sent it to me at my home. He gets disturbing, most threatening letter to me by sending it to his family in Pennsylvania and then sending it to my home in New York. And I never get to read it because it's that bad. And so my dad, you know, they turn it over to the DA's office, and, you know, Ray gets his hand spanked and said no more mailing privileges. Well, not only does he get to send mail, he got to go online and talk to people through a website outside of prison that was interested in having a friendship with death row inmates. And so ultimately, that's how we find out more information about Ray. Because one of my family members who lived in Florida contacted us in July of 2004 and had told us that they saw a website for death row inmates and a memorial for Ray on this website. And so she's telling us that he died. And we have no information on it and are kind of freaking out because that's some big information that we would like to know. So I eventually get this information and I find out that he did in fact die, and he died of lung cancer, and it was an end to the nightmare.
And how old were you at that time in 2004?
I've graduated and entered into the State Police Academy at this point. This went on till, you know, almost 15 years ago. This horrible tragedy happened to our family, but I was able to pull out of this horrible situation and turn it into a positive by becoming a New York State Trooper, my lifelong career goal. And so he may have lived 15 more years than he should have, but I had the last laugh. Mm-hmm. And I get to arrest monsters like him and prevent him and others like him away so they don't get a chance to do this to other innocent people, innocent kids.
And when did you come around to being more open about your story?
I never thought it would be something that I would be so open about until it was in high school that my mother tried to win custody back of my brother and I. And it was Florida courts was requesting our presence in their court for us to tell them that we didn't want to be in Florida. We didn't want to live with our mother. And why we didn't want to live with our mother. We were talking to therapists and we were talking to the police, and it came down to it where my father had said, you know, I'm not sending those kids back to Florida. I'm not doing it. And so Florida issued a warrant and said that, you know, my father will be arrested. My dad said, well, I guess I'm not going to Florida then. And he was our rock. And that is why we did so well. So my dad didn't force us to go down. The police came to our door and asked us if we wanted to go with our mother. And we declined and they pushed no more and walked away, apologizing for interrupting our evening. And that's how it went. It was wonderful. The community was behind us. The only problem was is that none of that mattered because the courts felt that they had the power. And so the judge in Florida granted my mother custody without hearing us out or anything.
What?
Yes. So that is where everything kind of blew up. All of a sudden, I'm being told.
Wait.
Yes.
I have to make sure I heard you right. Mm-hmm. So now you're in high school. He's already mm-hmm. been convicted. He murdered right. your sister and tried right. to kill you and did all of these horrible things. And he was the boyfriend right. of your mother.
Yep, you got that okay. right.
And in fact, the judge said your right. mother gets custody.
Okay. Yeah, exactly. So we all freaked out, and pretty much it came down to it where I was asked to speak to the media. And so I had every channel, local channel, interviewing me. Here I am, a high school student, and they're interviewing me on why my brother and I don't want to go back to Florida. And it's blowing up in the paper and on TV. And there, you know, there was a protest a march at our Hall of Justice where I spoke out to 200 plus people about what happened and why I don't want to go back down to Florida to live with my mother. And it just blew up from there, and it worked. We had attorneys call in, and specifically Lou Gould said that he would take our case pro bono. And that's where the battle began between New York and Florida. And we won. We won to stay where we were safe, and we were where we were living a healthy life and moving forward. But it took a great toll on our family to do all of this.
Your story is so unbelievable, Saya, from beginning to end. I just, you know, I hear it and I'm horrified. I'm angry. I'm so many things.
I'm just thankful that I have been given life and have been able to be a positive impact. I've spoken to children. I've spoken to victims one-on-one, their families, anybody who will listen, who I feel that it will impact them and give them the tools to be able to work as a team. Because honestly, we can't do it alone. If we can work together, it accomplishes so much more.
Are you in contact with your mom now?
Yes. So it was pretty close to 25 years since I really had a conversation with her. And just this year, February, my brother and I went to go visit her. I had a lot of resentment, a lot of questions I had for her that I just clearly wasn't getting the answers to. And I came to a point where I forgave my mother. I had to let go of what I was holding on to, and that the answers wouldn't help. They wouldn't really help me. And where I was in a good place. And I'm blessed with the family that I have, the friends that I have. And I feel sorry for my mother. And, you know, my brother and I think, got to a point where we felt that this was our time to say goodbye because she was sick and we didn't know if there was any other chance that we would get. So we went there knowing that this is just our chance to be able to be okay with it if it's our last time we see her. We had a very tough conversation with her, and she's the one that brought it up. She asked us, okay, what questions do you have for me? We had to strongly tell her that, listen, Mom, these things happened. And she denied them. And then my brother and I both stood strong and said, no, Mom, these things happen. And she's like, I just don't remember. I don't remember it. I'm like, well, we're telling you it happened.
Saya, what advice do you have for families out there?
The advice I have is to always have hope. Without hope, you have nothing. Never giving up and knowing that you can make a difference. Because we can't get Sarah back, but we can help others with preventing this happening to them. Or if we can't help prevent it from happening, help them cope through it. You know, I was a victim, a survivor, but most importantly, I'm a fighter. And that's because I didn't give up hope. The power of positive thinking is an amazing thing.
Saya, tell me about the shoes that you bring to your presentation.
Those are my Punky Brewster sneakers that I wore that night. And that is just a symbol of what I had gone through. But more importantly, I learned from those shoes. Once we found out back in 2004 that he had died, I graduated from the academy and I was approached by some of my supervisors and they asked me if I would be interested in being a speaker for their sex offense seminar. And that was huge. So I put together a PowerPoint presentation, and it's such a unique position that I have because, yes, I was a victim and a survivor of a horrific crime. I'm the police officer that's investigating these types of crimes. I have, you know, this unique look and ability to be able to see both sides. I run with that, and I work with a strong passion to do that. And so I went to Santa Rosa County and I requested to receive any evidence that they still had left from the case since it was closed. And so I, you know, paid for numerous amounts of copies and there the crime scene photos. There was a few photos of the crime scene that was in there. There was certain pieces of jewelry that my sister had on and a watch that I had on and my Punky Brewster sneakers. And so those things were turned over to me. And it was as mixed emotions for sure, but I just felt like a little piece of my life was given back to me and that I was able to fill in, wow, you know, those holes, those voids that I had. And so those shoes I carry with me as a symbol of my life and what happened to our family.
And how you survived.
And ultimately, yes, how I survived. And now I fight for those who need it.
Saya, you're right. It's a hard story to hear, but thank you for telling it. Because you are making a difference.
Ultimately, I want to be a positive impact. If it ever became something that was unhealthy, I would step away.
Yeah.
Because that's the important part of this. It's very difficult. It is not an easy situation to be able to be in, but I wouldn't be in it if I didn't have the right tools to get through it, cope with it, understand that this is my mission. And if I help one family, one victim, it's all worth it.
We appreciate your passion and we appreciate everything you do to help children out there. I think you're a hero to kids and adults.
Thank you.
You are just an amazing, beautiful inspiration.
Thank you, I appreciate that.
And that's it for this episode of Survivors and Heroes on Inside Crime. For more on this case and to hear a bonus audio clip, go to our website, insidecrime.com. Thanks for listening, everyone. I'm your host, Angeline Hartman. Be sure to subscribe so you don't miss an episode of Inside Crime.